I see our brother Harold has all sorts of goodies up here hidden behind the podium, so I'm sure it'll be an exciting and an interesting class. Without any further ado then, Father Harold.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, thank you, Brother Chairman, for telling the story that you shouldn't have told, but that's okay. Maybe they all even pay attention now, expecting some excitement. Well, we're doing Zechariah 11, where we started with Zechariah 1, so we're doing fairly well after about a year, and the prophecy of Zechariah. When we think of prophecy, we think of exposition. And when exposition is done properly, we hopefully can gain some exhortation out of it as well. Now, you may have noticed in this chapter 11 that there are 17 verses, and six times during that chapter, when we read that chapter, we heard the word shepherd or shepherds. And you have to ask the question, why was that? Well, when we find the answer to who these shepherds are, we will actually find the exhortation that is in this chapter. Now, one verse in chapter 11, which you probably noticed right away, was verse 11, which, because it provides a major clue as to the era when this prophecy will have its main fulfillment. And those words were, "They weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver." And this verse puts our minds right away into the first century A.D., What are you girls and boys laughing at? Doesn't matter. But I must have said something with an accent or something. The verse puts our minds into the first century A.D., doesn't it? We think of the New Testament incident of Judas Iscariot taking the 30 pieces of silver and then eventually throwing them on the temple floor. And that's good, because right away this chapter is taking us into the life of Jesus Christ. And if prophecy can do that, then we've reached the goal of why we read prophecy. So let's do a quick overview of this chapter, and we'll see what we're going to look at this evening. Verses 1 to 3 are speaking of the Roman invasion of Israel. Through the years 66 to 70 A.D., which was the punishment of God meted out upon the Jewish people. And verses 4 to 14 give the reason why. Why was this a punishment administered? And right away we know that it's because of the shepherds of Israel leading the nation into apostasy. And we'll see how they did that. In verses 15 to 17, there's an entirely new era developed in those last few verses as we move right into the 21st century and the apostate shepherds that we can find in this century. Now, the main lesson that we should grasp out of this chapter, if we're going to get anything out of it at all, is we should be assessing how well we are doing individually, because we all have a job to do, and that is to be a shepherd or a shepherdess. And how well are you doing at that job? We should be assessing ourselves. So let's read verses 1 to 3 of Zechariah chapter 11. And as we're reading this, we'll have a look at this little map which has some of the place names we see here. Open the door, thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars. Howl, fir tree, for the cedar is fallen, because the mighty are spoiled. Howl, O ye oaks of Bashan, for the forest of the vintage is come down. There is a voice of the howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled, a voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled. Now in verse 1 we have Lebanon, which as we know is to the north of Israel, and on this map it's L-E-B, so that's Lebanon. Then in verse 2 we have Bashan, and you may not have realized that Bashan is the same as the Golan Heights, according to some authorities. And Golan Heights is outlined in purple on this map. But that is Bashan of this chapter. And then Jordan. It's not the nation of Jordan that is being spoken of here, but the primary river in Israel. So we're looking at Israel. And these are the places that were overrun by the Romans as they came down from the north. They were sent by God to punish Israel during the years 66 to 70. And we think of the cedar of Lebanon. But this cedar is also used in verse 2 to describe the main leaders in Israel. And there's other trees, of course, mentioned, the fir and the oak. And they would be lesser officials, those who were leaders, but not as high. And they too would feel the wrath of God administered through the Roman legions. In Ezekiel 11, verses 1 to 3, Ezekiel talks about Israel as being young lions. The tribes of Israel are young lions. So here in Zechariah, when it talks about lions, verse 3 tells us that the fate of the Israeli lion is to be spoiled. And that was the pride of lions, if you like. The pride of Jordan was to be spoiled by the Roman armies. So that's the first section, verses 1 to 3. And then we come to the second section, the reason why they were punished. And let's just look at verses 4 and 5 to start with. Thus saith the Lord my God, feed the flock of the slaughter, whose possessors slay them and hold themselves not guilty. And they that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich, and their own shepherds pity them not. So this is why Israel was to receive such great punishment. It was because the shepherds of Israel were doing such a poor job. And verse 4 is saying, feed the flock of slaughter. Obviously, the flock of slaughter is going to be Israel. In another translation, the English Standard Version says, become shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter. So this is a prophecy that wasn't very nice. You can imagine if you were listening to Zechariah, you wouldn't be very happy if you were an Israelite to be told these things, that you were doomed to slaughter. And this slaughter did happen. There's a map here showing the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. Israel was to be the flock of slaughter as they fell into the hands of their possessors, the possessors being the Romans in verse 5. And on this map, you notice the arrows on the map and a little caption at the bottom. There's eight points as the Romans, first of all, attacked and took the northern part of the city. And they penetrated the third wall, and then they gradually, systematically went from sector to sector, taking each sector and destroying people as they went. So Rome would possess Israel because of the poor leadership of Israeli shepherds. Now the leaders in Christ's day were corrupt, and the people followed the leaders' poor example, resulting in punishment to both the leaders and the commoners. See, there's a lesson there for us. We have to realize that people rely on leadership. And good shepherds lead by example. So we just can't tell people what to do. We have to show them. Look at John chapter 11 for a moment. John chapter 11 gives you an attitude that was rampant in those days amongst the leaders of Israel. John 11, verses 47 and 48. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many miracles." Can you imagine that? The chief priests are talking about the Messiah, and they say, "What are we going to do about this guy?" Which is terrible. "If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him." Well, that would be good, wouldn't it? Listening to the Messiah, but no, they didn't like that. "Because the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation." So the chief priests had this attitude. It was very important that under no circumstance should they be losing their place of authority, a place which was centered around the temple, but they had this political appointment and they wanted to keep it. It wasn't inherited. They were politically appointed people. And as such, this place of authority could easily be removed by the Romans, and a new political appointment could be made. So how did the shepherds of Israel sell the nation to the Romans? That's what the verse says, isn't it? Well, by abandoning godly principles. The politically minded high priests influenced the people to also do the same thing. They were not leading by example. They were just showing how that selfishness was the way to go. And as so often happens in the history of Israel, when the nation abandoned God, then God abandoned the nation. And for one reason, to secure a change of their attitude. And that's why they would be abandoned. Looking at verse 6. "For I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord, but lo, I will deliver the men, every one, into his neighbor's hand, and into the hand of his king. And they shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them." Now, a key phrase in that verse is right in the middle of the verse. Did you notice it? God would allow the ordinary Israeli citizen to suffer at the hands of the Romans, and the phrase was, "I will deliver the man into the hand of his king." Now, when we consider the trial of Jesus Christ and we think of the king that they wanted, there was a statement by the shepherds of Israel. In John chapter 19 and verse 15, we find out which king is being referred to there when we hear the chief priests saying, "We have no king but Caesar." And here they're being delivered into the king they wanted. But it wasn't just the shepherds. We might say, well, that was the shepherds. The common people, they didn't want that. But we're also told in Matthew 27 and verse 25, words that indict the entire population, at least a great majority. "Then answered all the people, his blood be on us and on our children." So there's a lesson here we must learn. We have to grasp that the shepherds of the ecclesia can lead the people down the wrong track. They can lead the congregation into apostasy. So what does that tell us?
that the congregation also has a great responsibility to recognize when that is happening, if it ever happens, and refuse to be led down the wrong path, because that's what happened in Israel during the days of Christ. Also notice another phrase in Zechariah 11 and verse 6. It says, I will deliver the man, everyone, into his neighbor's hand. And this again is very descriptive of this siege of Jerusalem, because every day one faction or another, you see, the Jews were not united. There were factions within their city. And one faction would be fighting with another faction. Instead of concentrating upon the common enemy, which was Rome, the Roman invaders, Jews were actually killing Jews. And when we come to Zechariah 11, chapter 11, verses 7 to 14, the next 7 or 8 verses, we find Zechariah doing something which a lot of the prophets did. They started performing. Zechariah became a leading man in a pantomime, or more correctly, a demonstrated parable, using two sticks, one of which he called beauty, and the other which he called bands. Now let's have a look at verse 7. And I will feed the flock of slaughter, even you, O poor of the flock, and I took, so here he is, he's taking stuff. I took unto me two staves, the one I called beauty, and the other I called bands, and I fed the flock. So you sort of have to get the idea that there he was, standing in front of a whole bunch of people, and saying, I'm going to take these two sticks. One I'm going to call beauty, or favor, or grace. These are other words that he could have been translated. And I'm going to take another stick, which is bands, or binder, or union, or unity, and I'm going to tell you a story. And the message from these two sticks is that God is the good shepherd who extended favor or grace to Israel while they were united together to do his will. And as an ecclesia, we have to listen to that advice. We have to be united together. So in pantomime, Zechariah pretended now to protect this flock called Israel and warn them that they could become the flock of slaughter if they were not careful, should they stray. So he has an audience. And verse 8, 3 shepherds also I cut off in 1 month. My soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me. Now, Zechariah was speaking to people who needed to understand a lesson. And there may have been people there who were on the verge of going the wrong direction. But these verses are primarily applied to the future, because that's the primary purpose of chapter 11, is to bring us into the first century. And who do you think the 3 shepherds were in the first century but the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees? And in Matthew chapter 23, verses 29 to 33, Christ describes these people as hypocrites, serpents, a generation of vipers. Such a description fits well the words of Zechariah 11, verse 8. Generation of vipers. And we believe that Christ is here speaking through the mouth of the prophet to us. He is saying, my soul loathed them. Who was he loathing? Who was Christ loathing? He was loathing these false shepherds. Now, the Hebrew word for loathe has the sense of being grieved. Grieved or losing patience with or being wearied by these people who could not see their Messiah and that grieved Christ. Verse 9 of Zechariah 11. Then said I will not feed you. So this is Christ speaking now through the mouth of the prophet. I will not feed you. That dieth, let it die. And that is to be cut off, let it be cut off. And let the rest eat everyone the flesh of another. Now some 40 years after the nation of Israel officially rejected their Messiah, their sealed fate became a reality. According to Josephus, mothers who had babies during the siege hid them for food because that's all they had to eat. The population was being starved to death by the Roman invaders. And it was a tactic of warfare which was quite common to starve the people to death. And then they would engage in this bizarre activity of eating one another. Verse 10. And they took my staff, even beauty, and cut it asunder, that I might break my covenant which I had made with all the people. So you can imagine the scene. He takes this stick that he had. He has a knife or a saw or something. And it means favor or grace. And what does it do? He takes it and he breaks it and puts it down and says that he's going to remove. God is going to remove from the nation of Israel favor or grace. And this is very like the parable that we remember in Matthew 22. Remember that parable where the people are invited to the wedding of a king's son? And the people say, no, we don't have time. We're not going. But there's no stick in that Matthew account, but the parables have the same message, don't they? They have the same message, because there's a penalty for saying, I don't have time for a king's son. And the grace of that king was now removed in the parable. And they had rejected Christ. The people of his day had rejected him. And Matthew 22 verse 7 says, and the king was wroth. And he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. So because the grace of God was cut off, that's why the Roman army was allowed to come in and defeat the people of the covenant. So both parables were fulfilled, the Old Testament one and the New Testament one, both fulfilled in AD 70. And there's another lesson there, isn't there, that we must recognize that divine favor or grace can be removed from anybody, even ourselves, if godliness is abandoned. Look at Zechariah 11, verse 11. And it was broken in that day. So the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. So Zechariah has been speaking to this group of people in front of him, and there's people there who are not bad at all. They're the poor of the flock that waited upon me. The faithful ones who were paying attention to what Zechariah was saying, even as there were people in Christ's day that were paying attention, yet it seems the whole nation perished, was scattered. But the poor of the flock in any age knows something, that whatever happens to them physically is not as important as holding firm to the faith they had. And that's what the faithful will do, knowing that the kingdom is coming regardless of what happens to them physically. And they will be resurrected to be part of that time. So try to imagine the scene. Christ has this audience of faithful followers, but as well in that group, most of them are ambitious, skeptics who looked upon this parable that he was performing as being very negative. And you can't really blame them in a way, because they just come back from Babylon. They've been there for 70 years in captivity, and here they were building a temple, and they didn't want to hear all this negative stuff. Anyway, verse 12. And I said unto them, if you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. So this mixed multitude of Jews was now being asked, well, what do you think of my service to you? As Zechariah the prophet, have I done a good job? And how much do you think it's been worth? Because he had encouraged them, you remember, to rebuild the temple. He got them going. They got the temple built now. And how much do you think my service has been worth, he says. And they came up with this 30 pieces of silver. Now, was that a lot of money, or was it an insulting amount? There's the 30 pieces of silver. That's how much you're worth. Well, probably it was an insulting amount. You remember, the money was thrown down later on right into the temple of Zerubbabel. One good reference that tells us it's a poor amount is the Bible class by Jack Clover the other day. He says it's only worth $120, 30 pieces of silver. And that's probably right, although I figured it out, it was about $98, but $120. It's a very small amount, isn't it, when you think of all the effort that Zechariah went to. On today's market, an ounce of silver is worth about $7, and 30 pieces of silver weighs 13.5 ounces. So we got about $100, $120, and it's all very relevant information, because it shows you just how much Judas Iscariot thought of the Lord Jesus Christ in terms of value, and how much the chief priests thought of Christ in terms of his value. And you know, Jesus Christ was a willing slave of God, and he was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. And in Exodus 21 and verse 32, we are told that 30 pieces of silver was the amount that must be paid to the owner of a slave when that slave had been gored by an ox. And here Christ was getting the same amount of money, at least that was appeared to be what he was considered to be worth. And you know, Christ was, at his crucifixion, he was gored. Think about that. He, not by horns, but he was gored by nails. He was gored by thorns on his head. And eventually he was gored by a spear in his side. And remember what he did on the cross? He recited Psalm 22. And verse 12 of that psalm says, many bulls have compassed me. Bulls or oxen. Strong bulls of Bashan have set me around. And they were responsible for the death of Christ. Look at verse 13 of Zechariah 11. And the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized. This is sarcastic language, or language of disdain, if you like. Think of that. When it says goodly price, don't be fooled. It's the language of disdain. And the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was praised of of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord. So Zechariah now takes this money and he throws it into the temple of Zerubbabel that was finished in the year 516. Now, there's no record of a potter being employed in the temple precincts. So what did it all mean? Here he was. He takes the money and he throws it into the temple that Zerubbabel had finished. So what does it all mean? I cast it to the potter. There was no potter in that temple. Well, we go to Matthew chapter 27. Let's have a look at Matthew 27, and we'll read a few verses there, verses 3 to 10. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned, in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See thou to that. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple, and departed, and went and hanged himself. And the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them in the treasury, because it is the price of blood. And they took counsel and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. So that's why we have it in Zechariah, because of what's going to happen in Matthew. They bought the potter's field. Wherefore that field was called the field of blood unto this day. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet. Now, wasn't it Zechariah we read it in? Spoken of by Jeremy the prophet, saying, and they took 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord appointed me. So now, Zechariah, in taking this money and throwing it into the temple of Zerubbabel, is taking on the role, another role. He's a pantomime expert because he's got so many roles. He's now taking on the role of Judas Iscariot. Now, what finally happened to those particular coins that Zechariah threw, it doesn't really matter. The coins mentioned in Matthew were used to purchase a field from a potter to create a cemetery in which to bury strangers. And that's what Zechariah is looking ahead towards. But you did notice something, didn't you, in verse 9, where it says, where Matthew attributes the event to the fulfillment of a prophecy by Jeremiah. But notice the wording is very careful. Well, at least it is in the King James Version. It's something spoken by Jeremiah, or a saying, you could say, by Jeremiah, a saying of Jeremiah. But it was never something that Jeremiah put down on paper and that got into our Bible as the book of Jeremiah. We can't find it in the book of Jeremiah, so it was something that Jeremiah spoke rather than wrote. And this saying must have been uttered by Jeremiah in the 600s B.C. And it was probably known to all the Jews of that day, and it was probably known to the Jews that went into captivity, and they would have talked about it. And when Zechariah returned from captivity in the year 536 B.C., and then eventually wrote this chapter 11, 20 years later, sometime after 516, you see how God, the power of God, is working in this man's life. It was through the power of the Spirit that Zechariah was able to record words that Jeremiah had uttered concerning 30 pieces of silver over 100 years before. That's when they were uttered. Verse 14 of Zechariah chapter 11. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. So now Zechariah takes his instrument, whether it's a saw or a knife, whatever, and he publicly saws this other stick in half, bands, union. What does it mean? Well, he was publicly demonstrating the fate of the nation of Israel in the first century, in AD 70. It was God that required this fate to happen or was it? No, it wasn't. It was the nation of Israel that deserved this fate. It was the foreknowledge of God that they would take the attitude that they took, realizing they had a stony heart, and it would bring upon them this deserved punishment. Now, the first stick that we broke, that Zechariah broke, was beauty, indicating that the favor of God was removed from Israel. And now the second stick, the unity of the nation was to be broken, and they were to be scattered all over the world because of their stony heart. Now, why was that? Because Israel was destined to reject. Zechariah was looking ahead, and he was realizing that Israel was destined to reject their Messiah and follow the ways of the three shepherds of verse 8 of Zechariah 11, namely the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and that was their fate because of that rejection. Well, this brings us to the last part of Zechariah 11, verses 15 through 17, and it takes us right into the 21st century. Now, why would there be this sudden jump? Well, this is almost like an introduction, if you will, an introduction into the next three or four chapters, chapters 12, 13, and 14. Because those chapters are the same way. They're taking us right into the 21st century as well. So this is an introduction into the next chapters coming up. And it's ultimately showing Christ's ultimate triumph. Christ will triumph. And we again see Christ in the prophets. So let's read verses 15 to 17. And the Lord said unto me, take unto thee yet the instruments of a foolish shepherd. For lo, I will raise up a shepherd in the land, which shall not visit those that be cut off, neither shall seek the young one, nor heal that is broken, nor feed that that standeth still, but he shall eat the flesh of the fat, and tear their claws in pieces. Woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. Notice the spelling of the word idol there. The sword shall be upon his arm, and upon his right eye. His arm shall be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. So the terms foolish shepherd of verse 15 and idle shepherd of verse 17 are terms of warning. So Zechariah is sending a message to you and me. Christendom today is miles away from the truth. They're foolish shepherds, they're idle shepherds. And Paul warns us, doesn't he, in Acts chapter 20 and verse 29, for I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Now shepherds were supposed to feed the flock. Wolves ate the flock. And this is very descriptive of the man of sin and the false prophet, both of which are found in the New Testament as well. The leaders of Christ's day had a problem. The leaders of Christianity today are not feeding the truth to their flock. Parallel problems. First century problems, 21st century problems. Today, the leaders of Christianity are feeding words to the flock that tickle their fancy. And Paul warns about that in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. Paul says, for the time will come when they, that is the congregation, will not endure sound doctrine. Almost like Zechariah's day, they didn't want to hear what they were hearing. But after their own lust, they shall heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they, that is the teachers, shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned unto fables. Now, why would they do that? Why would preachers willfully deceive? Can you think of a reason why they would do that? Well, the answer is money or power or both. Now, if Angie Gunville is here, I don't think she is. You have not to laugh at that picture. But that is a seven-headed beast. And it's describing the Roman Empire at various stages in history. That's why you can't see all seven heads at once, because the other are way back in history. So that's why you can't see them all. So let's read Revelation chapter 17, verses 3 to 6. And have a look at this picture while you're at it. Revelation 17, verses 3 to 6. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration or astonishment. So in these verses in Revelation, the woman in verse 3 is the papacy. In verse 4, we can see luxury. We read luxury there. We think of the Vatican millions. And the phrase abominations and filthiness of a fornication, that speaks of idolatry and false doctrine. And verse 5 talks about the mother of harlots. And that's very interesting, because that is exactly what the papacy claims to be. Back in the year 1543, at the Council of Trent, the papacy claimed the role of mother and mistress of all churches. So obviously the harlots of verse 5 are those other churches that are teaching the same false doctrine to their members. Now in verse 6 of this chapter, in Revelation 17, we see John warning the brethren and sisters of his day, back in AD 96, to beware of this mother of harlots system, because he foresaw the atrocities that they were capable of committing. And you know that happened? That happened in the days of Tyndale and the like in the 1500s. And in Zechariah 11, that phrase, the idol shepherd that I asked you to think about. But you know, at one time it was very dangerous to question or criticize the papacy. The Pope required people to treat him as though he were a god, as an object to be worshipped. We get that out of Revelation 13 as well, that it would happen. But it happened historically. If you look at Revelation 13, verses 14 and 15. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Now the beast in this verse, in these verses, is the empire of the papacy, the same as that red beast on the overhead. And so that's the empire. And they were required, people of the empire were required to worship the Pope himself. And then, you know, there's every indication that this situation will repeat itself. The papacy will become very, very powerful once again prior to the end of Gentile times. So the Pope was an image to be worshipped, or an idol. And the death penalty for non-compliance to his decrees, well, that's going to come to an end, as we read in Zechariah 11 and verse 17. This will not happen again forever, because it will eventually come to an end. Zechariah 11 and verse 17. Woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm shall be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened. Now in this verse, the arm is the papal system with its influence throughout the world. And the eye, what is the eye? The eye is the vast ecclesial network, ecclesiastical network, its embassies all over the world. The churches are the eyes of the papacy. And together, the arm, the influence, and the eye, they make a very powerful force. But this system is also identified in Revelation as Babylon. In chapters 17 and 18, if you get the chance to read those two chapters, you see how the decline of Babylon is very graphically described. The Roman Empire, the latter day Roman Empire. In fact, all systems, whether they have this title Rome or not, all systems that currently influence the earth in a negative way, all systems will be removed from the earth in due course. If you look at Revelation 20 in verse 2, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent which is a devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. So that is going to come to an end. And the kingdom age will begin. So in conclusion, what have we done tonight? We've seen, first of all, how Israel was punished by the Romans in AD 70. And we've seen how God allowed Israel to be scattered because of apostasy, being led down the garden path by false shepherds. We've seen how the grace of God was removed, and then the unity of the nation was dissolved when they were scattered throughout the world. And the last part of Zechariah, we've seen how Zechariah looks ahead to the foolish shepherd and the idle shepherd of the 21st century. And today we have shepherds in the community at large which are leading people into oblivion. And we have to recognize that. And we also have to beware, as an ecclesia, that false doctrine that is taught to the masses does not influence the ecclesia. We don't want false doctrine to infiltrate, because it's a matter of life and death that we keep it out. So we must practice the truth in order to become useful for the day that is to come. Because there is a day, you know. 1 Peter 5 verse 4 says, and when the chief shepherd shall appear, the chief shepherd, who's that? That's Jesus Christ. He's going to appear, and you shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. So we want to be among that number, don't we? Who will help the chief shepherd cleanse the earth so that the kingdom age can begin. Thank you.